all of these people who I love in my life, who wrote things, who wrote forewords for it. Kara Swisher and Sonny Hostin, Clive Davis, Anna Navarro, Lee Daniels. They all wrote very nice things. So go out and go get pre-order the book, order it for your friends and whatever. And the book tour, I'm going to put my book tour schedule up online so you'll know about that. Okay. So let's see what you guys have to say today. I will purchase the book. Will you be having a book signing in New Orleans? Yes, I will try to make my way to New Orleans, but get the book. And if I make my way to New Orleans, I promise you, I will sign it. And if I ever get to whoever, whatever town that you're in, I will sign the book for you. And if I can't sign your book, I'll sign a book plate for you and send it to you so that you can put it in the book if you buy it. I promise you, I will do that. Beth H. says, I am Episcopalian and put my son in Catholic high school and Lutheran elementary school, was ready for college. Yes, it taught me discipline. Norman Soward says, boo, CNN. I'm not sure why, Norman, you're saying that. Will your book tour come to Toronto, Canada? Glennis Fitzpatrick said, I don't think so at this point, but if there's enough of a demand, I will. I have done my last book tour. I did stuff in Canada, but it was virtual, and we actually had really good sales in Canada. I actually love Canada. I used to go to the, TIFF, which is the Toronto International Film Festival every year. Thank you, Fiercely Independent, for supporting independent media. I really appreciate that. I was strapped by nuns. I was too, as a child, Norm Wilson says. I was strapped as well. And also we had the ruler and the pointer. And what we had to do was, when we were getting the ruler and the pointer, we had to, they bent our hands back like this so they could get us good. And if they didn't do that, they did it. They got us on the butt. What about Cleveland? You know, I was in these places. If there's enough of demand, I will drive to through America. Actually, I'm actually considering doing another tour going across America. Let me know if you guys would like to do this. Ordering your book, Don, says Sheila Wilson. Thank you, Sheila. Don Lemon for press secretary, says Norman Sorwitz. That would be great. I would love to be press secretary. I'm not sure they would be interested in me. I may have too much of a big mouth, but who knows? Eric C. says, hi, Don. Will you be in South Florida for your book tour? Yes, I have a Florida, I think a Miami date on the book tour. So look that up. We will probably put it online for you. Come to Columbus, Ohio, says Pamela Carter. Listen, I can come to you guys, or I can do a virtual event for you guys. I can send you a book plate, all of those things. So, guys, I love you. I'm so happy that you are still with us for this experience, for the Lemonation. By the way, I met so many people at the convention who came up to me and they said, hey, I'm a Lemonhead. I'm part of the Lemonation. I was so pleasantly surprised and so moved by it. So there are lots of folks out there like us, lots of like-minded Lemonheads and members of the Lemonation. So thank you, guys. I will see you tomorrow. Make sure you check out our content on social media. That way you can find out wherever I am. Make sure you go to my Instagram. I think it's, I forget what the page is called. It's like a For You. It's a personal page that you can go. I think it's a For You page on Instagram. And I give you like personal updates and things that you don't get necessarily on the rest of my social media. I've been a little bit ill, so I haven't engaged as much as I should, but I promise you I will. Our TikTok is on fire, everyone. So if you have not joined us on TikTok, you are missing out. Our Instagram is on fire, Facebook as well. X is, you know, there's a lot of haters on there. But, you know, it is what it is, which is the reason I wanted to join it, is to have a voice there, wanted to rejoin and at least. Okay, so thank you guys for joining. I'll see you tomorrow, if not sooner, if something happens. So Lemonheads, Lemonation, have a fantastic evening. Send me what you want to know, questions. Make sure you hit the thumbs up. If you have questions about the book, when you get it and you read it, we'll do like a book club and we'll answer questions. We'll read, you will do some reading online, etc. So go and pre-order, please, and make us proud for the bestsellers list. Okay. Have a great evening. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
go check my rotor. If I can spend the whole weekend with you, I won't be working over. There ain't nothing more worthwhile to do. You go check your rotor.
About how much someone drinks.
Do you feel angry or depressed most of the time? Do you feel neglected or unloved?
Do you feel that if the drinker loved you, she or he would stop drinking?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, you are not alone.
Not everyone trapped by alcohol is an alcoholic.
Families and friends are suffering too.
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Call 1-866-200-0223 or visit alanon.org/help.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, how Hurricane Helene could impact Florida's home insurance crisis was a recent Newsweek headline. A source in the story said smaller insurers were especially in danger. A layperson might wonder why events we pay insurance for should present a crisis for the industry we pay it to. But the ever-growing effects of climate disruption are only going to throw that question into more relief. Writer and historian Derek Seidman joins us to help understand what's happening with insurance and the climate crisis. Also on the show, if it comes to issues that many unaffected people are told to care strongly about, immigration from the southern border is high on the list. But how seriously should we attend to a public conversation where believing that your Haitian neighbors want to eat your pets is not a bar for entry? We'll talk about building a humane dialogue on immigration and asylum policy with Insha Rahman, Vice President of Advocacy and Partnerships at the Vera Institute of Justice and the Director of Vera Action. That's coming up, but first, a quick look back at some recent press. A U.S. Circuit Court panel looks ready to uphold a federal law that would effectively ban the social media network TikTok because it's owned by the Chinese company ByteDance. Representing, as Ari Paul writes for Fair.org, a new phase of legal attacks on the platform in which judicial interpreters of the Constitution are acting as Cold War partisans, threatening to throw out civil liberties in favor of national security alarmism. Earlier this year, despite protest, President Biden signed legislation forcing TikTok's owner to sell it or face a nationwide prohibition in the United States. The claim is that data collection, a function of most social media networks, poses a security threat because of the platform's Chinese ownership. To be clear, not its foreign ownership, it's Chinese ownership. The Wall Street Journal spelled it out in an editorial praising the potential ban, saying, quote, "What's really at issue is Chinese control of the app, and TikTok is owned by ByteDance, a Chinese company. TikTok is welcome to keep operating and its users to keep posting. The law merely says TikTok cannot do so while remaining what Congress calls a foreign adversary-controlled application," close quote. The leaders of the ominously titled House Select Committee on the Strategic Competition between the United States and the Chinese Communist Party filed an amicus brief with the court saying the law does not regulate speech or require any social media company to stop operating because it's focused entirely on the regulation of foreign adversary control. And you're hearing that right. China is officially designated as an adversary, along with Iran and Cuba, despite the fact that China and the U.S. have diplomatic relations and do billions of dollars in trade. The suggestion is that U.S. citizens should be denied access to news and views that are tied to so-called adversary countries. Fair and others have raised the concern that if TikTok is banned because of its Chinese affiliation, then Chinese newspapers and broadcasters, which many people rely on to inform themselves, could also be censored. These outlets have been failing federal heat ever since the U.S. State Department forced Chinese state media outlets to register as foreign agents. Well, unsurprisingly, the possible ban of a social media platform, seen by many as a platform for dialogue and community and news, is unpopular. Pew Research has the share of Americans supporting a government ban at 32%, down from 38% last fall. Meanwhile, the House of Representatives has passed legislation that would authorize more than $1.6 billion for the State Department and USAID over the next 5 years, part of which would subsidize media and civil society sources around the world that counter Chinese malign influence globally, reported Responsible Statecraft. And the outlet added, it's possible that the program could in some cases be used to subsidize covert anti-Chinese messaging, reminiscent of the way Russia is accused of covertly funding anti-Ukrainian messaging by U.S. media influencers. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. As we watch images of devastation from Hurricane Helene, it's hard not to hold alongside sadness at the obvious loss anger at the knowledge that things didn't have to be this way. Steps could have been, still could be, taken to mitigate the impact of climate change and making weather events more extreme. And steps could be taken that help people recover from the disastrous effects of the choices made. As our guest explains, another key player in the slow-motion train wreck that is U.S. climate policy, along with fossil fuel companies and the politicians that abet them, is the insurance industry, whose role is not often talked about. Derek Seidman is a writer, researcher, and historian. He contributes regularly to Truthout and to Little Sis. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Derek Seidman.
Hey, thank you. Great to be here.
Well, in your super helpful piece for Truthout, you cite a Washington Post story from last September. Here's the headline and subhead, quote, "Home insurers cut natural disasters from policies as climate risks grow." Some of the largest U.S. insurance companies say extreme weather has led them to end certain coverages, exclude natural disaster protections, and raise premiums, close quote. I think that drops us right into the heart of the problem you outline in that piece. What's going on, and why do you call it the insurance industry's self-induced crisis?
Thank you. Well, certainly there is a growing crisis. The insurance industry is pulling back from certain markets and regions and states because the costs of insuring homes and other properties are becoming too expensive to remain profitable with the rise of extreme weather. And so we've seen a lot of coverage in the past few months over this growing crisis in the insurance industry. But one of the critical things that's left out of this is that the insurance industry itself is a main actor in driving the rise of extreme weather through its very close relationship to the fossil fuel industry. And in this narrative in the corporate media, the insurance industry on the one hand and extreme weather on the other hand are often treated like they're completely separate things and they're just sort of coming together and this quote-unquote crisis is being created. And it's a real problem that the connections aren't being made there. So I guess a couple of things that should be said first are that the insurance industry is the fossil fuel industry, and its operations could not exist without the insurance industry. We can look at that relationship in two ways. So first, of course, is through insurance. The insurance giants, AIG, Liberty Mutual, and so on and so on, they collectively rake in billions of dollars every year in insuring fossil fuel industry infrastructure, whether that's pipelines or offshore oil rigs or liquefied natural gas export terminals. This fossil fuel infrastructure and its continued expansion, this simply could not exist without underwriting by the insurance industry. It would not get its permit approvals. It would just not be able to operate. It couldn't attract investors and so on. So that's one way. Another way is that, you know, and this is something a lot of people might not be aware of, but the insurance industry is an enormous investor in the fossil fuel industry. Basically, one of the ways the insurance industry makes money is it takes the premiums and it pools a chunk and it invests those. So it's a major investor. And the insurance industry across the board has tens of billions of dollars invested in the fossil fuel industry. And this is actually stuff that anybody can go and look up because some of it's public. So, for example, the insurance giant AIG, because it's a big investor, it has to disclose its investments with the SEC. And earlier this year, AIG disclosed that, for example, it had $117 million invested in ExxonMobil, $83 million invested in Chevron, $46 million in ConocoPhillips, and so on and so on. So on the one hand, you have this sort of hypocritical cycle where the insurance industry is saying to ordinary homeowners who are quite desperate, we need to jack up the price on your premiums, or we need to pull away altogether, we can't insure you anymore. While on the other hand, it's driving and enabling and profiting from the very operations, fossil fuel operations, that are causing this extreme weather in the first place, that the insurance industry has been using to justify pulling back from insuring just regular homeowners.
Well, this is a structural problem, clearly, that you're pointing to, and you don't want to be too conspiratorial about it, but these folks do literally have dinner with one another, you know, these insurance executives and the fossil fuel companies. And then I want to add, you complicate it even further by talking about knock-on effects that include making homes uninsurable. When that happens, well, then that contributes to this thing where banks and hedge funds buy up homes. So it's part of an even bigger cycle that folks probably have heard about.
Yeah, absolutely. This whole scenario, it's horrible because it impacts homeowners and renters. If you talk to landlords, they say that the rising costs of insurance are their biggest expense, and they are in part taking that out on tenants by raising rents, right?
Right.
But it also really threatens just global financial stability. I mean, with the rise of extreme weather and homes becoming more expensive to insure or even uninsurable, home values can really collapse. And when they collapse, aside from the horrific human drama of all that, and banks are reacquiring foreclosed homes that in turn are unsellable because of extreme weather and they can't be insured. The big picture of all this is that it leads to, you know, banks acquiring a growing amount of risky properties, and it can create a lot of financial instability. And we saw what happened after 2008, as you mentioned, right, with, you know, private equity coming in and scooping up homes. And so, yeah, it creates a lot of, you know, systemic financial instability, opens the door for financial predators like private equity and hedge funds to come in.
And it seems to require an encompassing response, a response that acknowledges the various moving pieces of this. I wonder, finally, is there responsive law or policy either on the table now or just maybe in our imagination that would address these concerns?
Well, there are organizers that are definitely starting to do something about it, and there are some members of Congress that are also starting to do something about it. For this story, I interviewed some really fantastic groups. One of them is Insure Our Future, and this is sort of a broader campaign that is working with different groups around the country and really demanding that insurers stop insuring new fossil fuel build-out, that they phase out their insurance coverage for existing fossil fuels, for all the reasons that we've been talking about today. At the state level, there's groups that are doing really important and interesting things. So one of the groups that I interviewed was called Connecticut Citizen Action Group, and they've been working hard in coalition with other groups in Connecticut to introduce and pass a state bill that would create a climate fund to support residents that are impacted by extreme weather. Connecticut's seen its fair share of extreme weather. And this fund would be financed by taxing insurance policies in the state that are connected to fossil fuel projects. So it's sort of also a kind of disincentive to investing fossil fuels. In New York, there a coalition of groups and lawmakers just introduced something called the Insure Our Communities Bill. And this would ban insurers from underwriting new fossil fuel projects, and it would set up new protections for homeowners that are facing extreme weather disasters. I spoke to organizers in Freeport, Texas, with a group called Better Brazoria, and these are people that are on the Gulf Coast, really on the front lines, and Better Brazoria is just one of a number of frontline groups along the Gulf Coast that are organizing around the insurance industry, and they're trying to meet with insurance giants and say to them, look, what you're doing is we're losing our homeowner insurance while you're insuring these risky LNG plants that are getting hit by hurricanes and fires are starting, and trying to make the case to them that this is just not even good business for them. And then more recently, you've seen Bernie Sanders and others start to hold the insurance industry's feet to the fire a little more, opening up investigations into their connection to the fossil fuel industry and how this is creating financial instability. So I think this is becoming more and more of an issue that people are seeing is a real problem for the financial system. And it's something that we should absolutely think about when we think about the climate crisis and the sort of broader infrastructure that's enabling the fossil fuel industry to exist and continue its polluting operations that are causing the climate crisis and extreme weather. So I think we're going to see only more of this going forward.
All right, then we'll end it there for now. We've been speaking with Derek Seidman. You can find his article, As Florida Floods, Insurance Industry Reaps What It Sowed, Backing Fossil Fuels, on truthout.org. Thank you so much, Derek Seidman, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, we can assume listeners know the popular right-wing lines. Immigrants, that's shorthand for black and brown immigrants, are criminals. Violent drug criminals especially, but also they're stealing jobs, draining social services, and in election season, we hear they're voting illegally in large numbers because they are in some way props for the Democratic Party. Anyone who wants to dispute those noxious tropes can do so with a search engine. Harder to combat is the overarching and bipartisan framing of immigration and immigrants as a problem. How do we replace batting away the latest slur with the reality-based, humane conversation we need to move us to the 21st century immigration and asylum policies we could have? Insha Rahman is Vice President of Advocacy and Partnerships at the Vera Institute of Justice and the Director of Vera Action. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Insha Rahman.
Thanks for having me, Janine.
Well, rather than ask you to engage intentionally misleading anti-immigrant talking points, I wonder if you would talk a little about the impacts. What is the fallout of myths and misinformation that might sound laughable or dismissible to many of us, but what's the fallout in the lives of the communities that you work with?
First of all, the Willie Horton playbook of exploiting voters' fears about crime and, frankly, the dog whistles about race and criminality, it's nothing new. When I say Willie Horton, right, everybody knows the 1988 ad that was run and allegedly sunk Michael Dukakis's Democratic bid for president. And it's a playbook that is old, well-worn. We've seen it every election cycle. And so this year in 2024, if you feel like you're hearing about immigration and migrants and cats and dogs nonstop, it isn't anything new. It is really just another page of the Willie Horton playbook. And it's not really about immigration or immigration policies. Every poll that we have done, that we have seen, has found that Americans by and large understand that immigration is a fundamental part of our society, of our economy, of our communities. We are a country of immigrants, but when it is wrapped up in a fear of crime and playing upon sort of racist tropes about crime and criminality, that's where it has political impact. And the fallout we can see. So one of the most depressing and staggering polls that I've seen recently is that overall support for immigration, which used to be majority of Americans, including independent and moderate voters, supported immigration to this country. They fundamentally believed immigration is a good thing for our communities, our families, our economy. Now that support has dipped for the first time to below 50%. And so there's a real fallout in terms of support for policy that's actually smart and sensible, that in fact made up the fabric of this country. And then we see it in very real ways in places like Springfield, Ohio, where there has been a lot of legal immigration of Haitian migrants to this country who are fleeing really devastating circumstances in Haiti. We're watching bomb threats in local schools, immigrant residents of Springfield feeling afraid. In fact, all residents of Springfield feeling afraid because suddenly the city that nobody had heard of until September 10th and the presidential debate is literally in the Klieg lights, and everyday Americans and a lot of politicians are talking about Springfield. So much so that even Republican governor of Ohio said, stop the fear mongering, stop the misinformation. We are just fine. What Springfield needs is our support and help and not fear mongering and rhetoric about it.
You know, I think that media give inadequate attention to the kind of carryover or bleed-through effects. It's not to say that people who fall for anti-immigrant misinformation, they're not asking folks before they harass them. To be clear, you're Haitian, right? You're not Dominican. I don't want to get my hatred wrong, you know? Mm-hmm. It's treated as though these are targeted attacks and as though they end when one particular incident is resolved or when the cameras go away. But of course, the impact on communities goes on and on.
Yeah.
changing facts on the ground with law, with policy, with institutional culture can save and can change lives. It also does also work to shift the dialogue about what's possible, about what life looks like after you change that law, for example. What are some of the legal or policy changes that you think could be important right now that could shift the ground on immigration and asylum?
One of the things that we have seen there's widespread support for and that can be done is just when there are new immigrants to our cities, to our communities, we make sure that they have the ability to work. Work employment is life-changing for everybody, including U.S. citizens and other members of the community who benefit from more labor. Right now, in many parts of this country, we have more jobs than we have people to fill them. And immigration is a necessary thing. It's why economists across the country, across the political spectrum, say we actually need immigration. We can't build a wall and mass deport people and shut down the borders because we literally will have an economic crisis in this country. So employment is a really basic thing we can do. Another thing is sometimes people hear, well, we need to make sure that folks who are coming to our cities, especially people who are bussed up from Texas and other border states, Florida, people resent housing and services and making sure basic needs are met. Well, in fact, that is cheaper than the alternative, and it is good for all of us, and it's not for forever. If you help somebody get on their feet with some temporary housing for 3 to 6 months, they have a work permit in hand, they have a job, they will not need to be dependent on government services and resources. It is actually better for us to set people up for a small period of time for future success. And we've watched some cities do that really well. For example, Boston did not engage in the kind of fear-mongering about all these newly arrived migrants. It's going to be the end of the city. It's going to destroy us, which is what we heard from a certain elected mayor in New York City. That wasn't the approach that Boston took. And in fact, they've had a lot of newly arrived migrants as well, and they've managed it. And you'll see they have really good outcomes, and there's generally a sense of positivity towards new arrivals there in a way that there simply isn't in New York City. And so again, there's some really clear policy things we can do for folks who have just come here, like work permits, like making sure there is transitional housing and support and services. All of that is a better investment in our communities and our economy than the alternative. And then we see there's always been and always will be widespread support for a path to citizenship and legalization for folks who have been here who are part of the fabric of our communities. And so those are some of the things we could do literally immediately, but at the local level in terms of cities and states, and then what we need to see Congress do. And 10 years ago, there was, in fact, bipartisan support for more paths to citizenship, and we need to bring the Overton window and shift it back to there because that's actually good for all of us. And one other thing I'll just mention as a policy point is even under the law as it is, and I would say we need to update the immigration law so that there's more legal paths to citizenship for folks, but even with the laws that we have, making sure people have lawyers, they have some basic due process before they are facing deportation means many more people access the asylum laws, other sort of forms of relief under current immigration law, which means it keeps people and families together. It keeps people in job. My organization, the Vera Institute of Justice, we run a national program where we're helping folks who are facing deportation have access to counsel, and literally people are 10 times more likely to win their case and be able to stay in the country, stay with their families, be in their jobs and in their communities than if they have to go through deportation proceedings without a lawyer. And there's no right to a lawyer in those proceedings. And that's a really big problem for keeping families and communities together.
Well, just finally, what would you be looking for in a healthy public conversation about the changes we need to get from where we're at to where we could be? And maybe who would be in that conversation that isn't being heard from so much now?
Too often the conversation about immigration is dominated by politicians who are looking to score cheap political points. And if you listen to their rhetoric, they don't have a single solution. Mass deportation is not a solution. Building a wall is not a solution. And you know who actually has, and maybe there's unlikely players in this, but folks who actually have very clear solutions for how we have a real and thoughtful conversation about immigration, that's business owners and chambers of commerce. And again, I made the point earlier that economists are like, if we just shut down immigration, if we deport everybody, our economy will collapse. Nobody understands that better than businesses and business owners. And they're actually a really important voice in this conversation that often get overlooked. Just to go back to Springfield, Ohio, that we talked about, we actually saw the local Chamber of Commerce and a number of different business owners go out and speak publicly on the record, on the nighttime news and the newspaper and city council hearings to say, we need our immigrant workers and family members and community members because they are a vital part of our economy. So I actually think that's a missing voice in this conversation that could help to sort of bring the polls together, because the right likes business. I think the left can live with business if business is coming at, you know, the issues in the right way. And I think there's an opportunity to really actually bring people together and have a more reasoned, thoughtful conversation about what the path forward is.
Well, we've been speaking with Insha Rahman, Vice President of Advocacy and Partnerships at the Vera Institute of Justice and the Director of Vera Action. Find their work online at vera.org. Thank you so much, Insha Rahman, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website, fair.org. That's also the place to show support for the show if you are able and so inclined. This show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
If you're talking, they will hear you.
We all want our kids to grow up safe and healthy. So we show them how. And we tell them with honest conversations that let them know what we expect. Not just one time, but every chance we get. That's especially important when it comes to alcohol and other drugs. Kids not only need to know the dangers and how to avoid them, they need to hear it often from you. And when it comes to pain medications, opioids, they need to know that they should never be taken without a prescription and never shared with friends or family. It's dangerous and illegal. So talk with your kids and guide them through the challenges of growing up safe and healthy. Because when you talk, they hear you. For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
So talk, they hear you. You can do it if you try.
Most of us like to be out in the sun. That's why sunscreen and other safety measures are key to protecting your skin from aging and cancer. The FDA recommends using a sunscreen with an SPF of 15 or higher. Also, look for broad spectrum on the label. That means both harmful ultraviolet A and B rays are blocked. Remember, SPF plus broad spectrum equal healthy fun in the sun. Visit www.fda.gov/sunscreen for more information. A message from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration.
I found hope in the midst of an overwhelming situation.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you. Call 1-866-200-0033 or visit alanon.org/hope.
Hey, guess what? We just hit the top of the hour here on 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh. We're going into the fourth hour of the Viva La Mock radio program. You know what that means. It's time to get into the mock. It is. Before I get into the mock, I want to remind you that Attic Records joins you in supporting WRCT. Yeah, Attic Records, they provide new and used records and CDs from metal to reggae, hip-hop to doo-wop, and all those stops in between. They're family-owned and operated. They pay for quality used records and CDs with no collection too big, no collection too small. It's Attic Records in Millvale. You can reach them at 412-821-8484. But would you believe it was on this very day, Mary Poppins made its film debut back in 1964. So we are celebrating the music of Mary Poppins and just Mary Poppins herself with a song, a set of, I don't know what it is, like eight songs that we call the Mock. So Mary Poppins is going under the Mock light tonight, and we're going to start things off from his It Feels So Good When I Stop album, and Joe Pernice.
Jim, Jiminy, Jim, Jim, Chiru, good luck will roll. Don't rest your head. Don't lie down upon your bed. While the moon drifts in the skies, stay awake. Don't close your eyes. Though the world is fast asleep, though your pillow's soft and deep, you're not sleepy as you seem. Stay awake, don't nod and dream. Stay awake, don't nod.
every job that must be done, there is an element of fun. You find the fun and snap the jobs again. And every task you undertake becomes a piece of cake, a lark, a spree. It's very clear to see that a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. Medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. In a most delightful way, a robin feather in.